Self-publishing, like politics, makes for unusual bedfellows. Not only authors, but also now small publishers are flocking to platforms that publish and sell ebooks. Welcome, everyone, to Copyright Clearance and his podcast series. My name is Christopher Keneally, host of Beyond the Book, and every week on Friday, we turn to the writers and editors of Publishers Weekly for a look at the week ahead, a preview of news that everyone in publishing will be talking about. Joining me from the offices of Publishers Weekly is Andrew Albanese, the magazine's features editor, and welcome back to the show, Andrew.
Greetings, Chris.
And I should add as well, welcome back to your offices. So you're able to get back into your offices there in Lower Manhattan. What's the view from PW?
Well, today, luckily, it's looking pretty nice out, but it's been pretty wet for the past couple of days. But suffice it to say, everything is working, and we're in a lot better shape than some of the poor people in the Rockaways and Staten Island are, for sure.
Well, indeed. Well, we hope things just get better for them and stay pretty well for you. So let's turn to the news right now, and Monday's issue has a digital focus. I guess almost every issue must have these days, but in particular, this one. Tell us about what you're covering.
Yeah, so you know, Monday's issue does very much have a digital focus. So much of the headlines focusing on the sales of ebooks in the digital age. Our Calvin Reed takes a look at some of the broader themes of the digital revolution that's going on. Notably, he points out a few things that are at work here. First, he writes about the rise of easy-to-use publishing platforms that can distribute globally. Second, the inherent speed and efficiency of digital. And of course, there's the rise of ebook demand globally. So far, the U.S. has really far outpaced the world in ebook sales. But as digital demand surges worldwide, that portends pretty big changes and potentially a very strong growth for the publishing business. It's a pretty fascinating piece, I have to say. And there's a lot of perspectives in there. Among the most interesting observations come from Smashwords CEO Mark Coker. You know, not only does Smashwords serve self-published authors, it serves a lot of smaller publishers, and it offers a range of distribution services. And among Coker's takeaways is that there are now 1 billion smartphones in use around the world and 1 billion more to come in the coming months and years. And while print isn't going away, you can now reach parts of the world where it was difficult, if not impossible, before. And that's a total game changer.
Well, indeed, you know, Mark Coker is a smart fellow. We've had him on the show several times, and indeed, he'll be joining me for a panel discussion on self-publishing at the Miami Book Fair coming up in about a week's time. And, he is not only just a smart businessman, but a real visionary. So that point that he's making there about a new market to be served through the smartphone, through the cell phone, is one I think authors and publishers should pay close attention to. And, you mentioned that devices are all a part of this. Particularly tablets. Apple has introduced its Mini recently, and I guess Calvin's got a review of those things.
Yeah, well, you know, Craig Teicher, our digital editor, has a review of the iPad Mini that's on our website now, and if you're wondering how that device is, how it functions, you should take a look at that. But also in Monday's issue, yes, Calvin Reed offers an update on his Tale of the Tablets. It's a feature we've done before, and we've updated again to take in all the new entries. And it does serve as sort of a great, handy, quick little reference for anybody, for publishers, and for anybody who really wants to get into e-reading. And in recent months, you know, you've had the iPad Mini out now. You've got the Google Nexus 7, which I have to say is my personal favorite. You've got the new Barnes & Noble Nooks. You've got Kindle Fires, the Kobo Arc, Galaxy Tab. Now you get these new Microsoft tablets with the snap-on keyboards, which are being advertised pretty heavily. It's pretty cool. There's a lot of these new entries in the field that can be tough to keep up with. And if you have any doubt about how fast the pace of change is going to be in the publishing business, well, this feature will also open your eyes to that because, you know, after all these new devices are useless without the content on them. So definitely something you'll want to take a look at on Monday and keep nearby our running tale of the tape for tablets.
Right. And digital certainly is a story not only in the devices and in the content, but in the reports that come out of the major houses every quarter. And we've got some news from Simon & Schuster.
Yeah, that's right. You know, we're really keeping, we always keep an eye on the numbers, obviously. But now as we get towards the end of the year, it's really interesting to take a look at how the numbers from the major publishers are shaking out. And Simon & Schuster, their third quarter results have just been released. And sales fell 5% from last year at Simon & Schuster. But operating income rose. And prominently, digital sales rose 20% in the quarter over last year. Now, you know, those sales were kind of offset by lower sales of print titles. But the higher percentage of digital sales actually meant better, more profits. You know, there's better margins on digital, and so SNS's profits were actually up. SNS CEO Carolyn Reilly told PW that she thinks that, you know, overall digital sales for the full year are going to end up representing in the low 20% range of SNS's total revenue, around 25%. I think that's a significant number. I think it's going to be really interesting to watch for the rest of the year how the digital marketplace shakes out. And it's going to be also interesting to watch how Sandy affects the bottom lines of the cleanup from Sandy affects publishers' bottom lines through the end of the year, too, which gives me another opportunity to once again wish everybody the best who's still digging out from the impact of that terrible storm.
Right. Well, we have come at least to the end of the hurricane season. That means the approach of the holiday season and time for a wrap up of the year's best books.
That's right. So PW, we put up our list of the year's best books. It's up on the site now. It's a great list this year. So we would love for people to, you know, continue to check that out and get involved on Facebook. Leave your comments, start a discussion of your own. And on that note, too, in Monday's issue, our columnist, former Seattle librarian Nancy Pearl, the great Nancy Pearl, will offer a list of her top 10 titles for 2012. She hesitates to call them best books. It's hard for her to choose among all the books she loves. She calls them her favorite books. But yes, another list in Monday's issue to go along with our 2012 best books of the year.
Well, with the proliferation of self-publishing and all the hundreds of thousands of titles now available, putting together that list must be a bigger chore than ever.
Oh, incredible. You know, we have a tavern on the first floor of our building here. And I think every day that the reviews editors would slip out a little bit and have a drink and sort of, you know, take their disagreements and discussions outside. I think that really sort of helped grease the skids for coming up with this list.
Well, at least if you're going to disagree about things, it can be about books, not about something something more contentious like national elections. Anyway, Andrew Albanese on this week of the presidential election. Thank you for joining us. Andrew is the features editor for Publishers Weekly and a regular guest here on our program.
My pleasure, Chris. Thanks for having me again.
Well, now I want to turn to Rose Fox, PW reviewer who blogs at Genreville. Welcome back to Beyond the Book, Rose.
Thank you very much. Always a pleasure.
Well, we look forward to having you join us every week and tell us about the review of the week or the reviews of the week. And so what books have you brought us this week?
In the fiction section, we start with Sam Lipsight's The Fun Parts, his second collection of short stories in which fierce satire mingles with warmth and pathos. He has a knack for stylistic variety that's on full display as characters tangle with thorny human experiences and complicated ties to the past. At least two stories are steeped in aggrieved boyhood, says PW's reviewer. The Dungeon Master slowly reveals the middle track path to nowhere existences of boys who gather after school for fantasy role-playing games. And Snacks presents the agony of being the fat kid who's confronted with the chance to ascend a little higher in the pecking order when a chubby classmate shows up. Lipsight's biting humor suffuses the collection, but it's his ability to control the relative darkness of each moment that makes the stories so engrossing. We also have stories in There Once Lived a Girl Who Seduced Her Sister's Husband and He Hanged Himself, which is the intriguingly titled collection from Lyudmila Petrushevskaya. These are full of meaningful, finely crafted detail. Set in Russia, the stories include two deities in which one night stand leads to pregnancy and surprising decisions, Ali Baba, about a woman who sells her mother's rare books to buy booze, and The Impulse, in which a mother shaves her head and ignores her son, who subsists on a diet of ice cream and frozen pizza. Our reviewer says the stories are both supremely gritty and realistically life-affirming. And we have a Q&A with George Saunders when we ask the author of the beloved short story collections Civil War Land in Bad Decline, Pastoralia, and In Persuasion Nation about moving in new directions with his fourth collection, 10th of December. He said, if you've got a certain rep, it induces a little panic because you're aware of what you do and want to use the best parts of that while avoiding falling into habit. But you also always look for opportunities to confound yourself. You want to honor what's authentic and earned while pushing into new territories.
In Mysteries is the return of Dr. Thomas Silkstone, an 18th century physician, and he features in a new book.
That's right. It's Tessa Harris's second Dr. Thomas Silkstone mystery, The Dead Shall Not Rest, in which body snatchers plague 1782 London. In particular, the unscrupulous anatomists covet the body of Charles Byrne, the celebrated 8-foot-tall Irish giant, who may not be long for this world. The book features well-rounded characters, cleverly concealed clues, and an assured prose style, which points to a long run for this historical series. We also have Christoph Spielberg's The Russian Donation, which won Germany's Friedrich Glauser Prize for Best Debut Crime Novel. This introduces reluctant detective Felix Hoffman, an attending ER position at a Berlin teaching hospital. This Don Quixote in scrubs and his girlfriend make a winning investigative pair as they look into the suspicious death of a Russian man on the hospital's cleaning staff. And the Q&A in the mystery section is with Stephen Hunter, author of The Third Bullet, in which master sniper Bob Lee Swagger critically examines the ballistics of the JFK assassination. In science fiction, C. Robert Cargill's debut, Dreams and Shadows, follows an unlikely pair of boys, Ewan, who is stolen as a baby by fairy goblins and replaced with a changeling, and Colby, an 8-year-old who encounters a djinn. The two come of age while exploring fairy lands and the even stranger landscape of Texas. Our reviewer says legends and fairy lore are given a dark urban twist with a raw, honest, and sometimes violent edge. We also cover Stephen Gould's Impulse. I don't know if you remember the movie Jumper, but it was based on Gould's novel, which he then followed with Reflex, introducing teleporters Millie and Davy. The third book in the series, Impulse, leaps to the next generation, following Millie and Davy's daughter Scent as she learns to control her teleporting talents and cope with high school while avoiding those who would manipulate her abilities for their own ends. And in romance, Alexa Egan's debut, Demon's Curse, is set in a colorfully imagined version of 1816 Britain, where shape-shifting Imnada hide from humans and the evil Fae blood. When an exiled Imnada warrior is murdered, two friends of his, an actress and a soldier, investigate his death while trying to unravel the research that got him killed. And naturally, they fall in love along the way. Our reviewer says that newcomer Egan beautifully paces the slow evolution of Bianca and Mac's relationship from cooperation through competent alliance to trust and affection.
And in the nonfiction section this week, you start off with a collection of essays.
Yeah, this is what our reviewer says is a whip-smart, achingly funny collection. It's called This Is Running for Your Life by film critic Michelle Orange. She trains her lens on aging, self-image, and the ascendancy of the marketing demographic, among other puzzles of the Facebook generation. Other topics include the evolution of the dream girl, the romance of the tragedy-driven artist, and the unsettling birth of neurocinema, a market research technique that's based on MRI scans. Though a travel memoir in Beirut falls out of step with the other pieces, this only testifies to the overall coherence of a collection whose voice feels both fresh and inevitable. In A History of Future Cities, featuring deft portraits of St. Petersburg, Bombay, Shanghai, and Dubai, journalist Daniel Brook, the author of The Trap, artfully condenses and illustrates three centuries of revolutionary urban development and globalizing impulses. The intended goal of promoting commerce with the wider world inevitably created heady mixes of cultural and political mores in these cities. The Communist Party of China thrived in 1920 Shanghai, a portal to the West that sowed the seeds of the People's Republic, and Bombay, now Mumbai, played a crucial role in fostering the movement that led to India's independence in 1947. We have a starred review of Black Against Empire, The Histories and Politics of the Black Panther Party. The question is, why did revolutionary black nationalism and black power mobilization generally become so influential in the late 1960s, and why did it unravel so disastrously in the 1970s? Historians Justin Bloom and Waldo Martin, the authors of No Coward Soldiers, undertake the formidable task of answering this question in a comprehensive history of the Black Panther Party and a theoretical analysis of revolutionary ideologies in the U.S. This is a prodigiously researched work. It includes academic literature, personal memoir, and conversations with former Black Panther members and associates, offering a densely detailed account of the transformation of a scrappy local organization into a major international political force. We also have an entirely different sort of history, Simon Garfield's exuberant history of maps called On the Map, in which innumerable modes of seeing the world unfold. The author loosely follows the development of cartography from the precociously scientific geography of the ancient Greeks to video game fantasy maps, along the way pursuing diverting cartographical anecdotes and oddities, including the centuries-long consensus that California was an island, the lingering conceit that women can't read maps, and the appearance and disappearance of canals on maps of Mars. Garfield's droll humor and infectious curiosity will keep readers engrossed as he uncovers surprising ways in which maps chart our imaginations as much as they do the ground underfoot. And finally, in nonfiction, despite Islam's position at the forefront of the American consciousness, the general public knows very little of its founder and prophet beyond platitudes and condemnations. In The First Muslim, Leslie Hazelton attempts to rectify this imbalance with a vivid and engaging narrative of Muhammad's life. The author portrays her subject as an unlikely and unsuspecting vehicle for the divine, painfully aware that too many nights in solitary meditation might have driven him over the edge. Sympathetic but not hagiographic, her work draws liberally from a long tradition of Islamic biographical literature about the Prophet, and the nuanced portrait that emerges is less that of an infallible saint than of a loving family man, a devoted leader of his people, an introspective and philosophical thinker who reluctantly accepted the burden of conveying the word of God, and a calculating political strategist. This fluid and captivating introduction will be invaluable for those seeking a greater understanding of Islam's message and its messenger.
Well, we'll turn now to children's and young adult books and start off with a picture book that is timely indeed, considering the events of this week.
Yes, now that the election is behind us, we have a much-needed reminder of American unity and cooperation. In America the Beautiful, 10 illustrators provide artwork to accompany the lyrics of Catherine Lee Bates' famous patriotic song. The contributors include Yuri Morales, John J. Muth, Raul Colon, Brian Collier, and Mary Grandpre, among many others who take inspirations from the song's references to Purple Mountain Majesties, Amber Waves of Grain, and Brotherhood. On the children's fiction side, we review A Pet Named Sneaker, the first book in nearly 20 years from writer Joan Hellbrenner, Hokey Pokey, a new middle grade novel from Newbery medalist Jerry Spinelli, and Gail Forman's Just One Day. Like Forman's recent paired books, If I Stay and Where She Went, Just One Day is the first half of a planned two-part romance about two teens who have a whirlwind affair in Europe, then lose track of each other. The second book, Just One Year, will be written from the perspective of the boy and will be published later in 2013.
And finally, Rose, the pick of the week sounds like a book destined for the silver screen.
Yeah, this is a really brutal and beautiful work. Eleanor Morse's White Dog Fell from the Sky, set in the late 1970s in Botswana and South Africa, and it explores the strength of friendship, the bonds of love, and the inhumanity regimes are capable of inflicting upon individuals. It features a South African medical student who flees after white police murder his friend. He's dumped in a field across the border in Botswana with nothing at all, but he's adopted by a persistent white dog, and he runs into an old schoolmate who's now working with the MK, the military wing of South African ANC. Slowly, their friendship grows with an American woman who's living in an old village, and of course, the ever-present white dog influences the story in unpredictable ways. Isaac struggles to survive torture in a fetid South African jail in a dramatic portrayal of what life can be like in this part of the world in the 1970s. So Botswana, South Africa, and the loyal white dog are characters as important and well-drawn as Isaac and Alice the American. Morse's unflinching portrayals of extremes of loyalty and cruelty make this a very memorable novel.
And Rose Fox, PW Reviews editor, who blogs at Genreville. Thanks so much for this week's review of reviews.
Anytime.
Beyond the Book is produced by Copyright Clearance Center, a global rights broker for the world's most sought-after materials, including millions of books and ebooks, journals, newspapers, magazines, and blogs, as well as images, movies, and television shows. You can follow Beyond the Book on Twitter, find us on Facebook, and subscribe to the free podcast series on iTunes or at the Copyright Clearance Center website, copyright.com. Just click on Beyond the Book. Our engineer is Jeremy Brisky of Burst Marketing. My name is Christopher Keneally. For all of us at Copyright Clearance Center, thanks for listening to Beyond the Book.